And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in over the years. You will also find all of my articles and blog posts, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded on the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage all listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce my special guest this evening. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is back once again. Dr. Johnson is a leading contributor to the Barnes Review and also hosts the very informative podcast, The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Johnson, welcome back, sir. How are you this evening?
Oh, it's great. It's been a long time since we've spoken like this.
Yes, sir, it has. It's been a while, and I'm glad to catch up. First off, how have you been? It's probably been, 2 years, I think, since you were last on the program. So how have you been? I know you've been staying busy writing for the Barnes Review, but what else has been up?
You know, it's for me, it's one of the great things about getting older is that, you know, you're established, you're settled, you know, it's not nearly as exciting as guys your age. I'm doing the same. I translate, I write, I do the radio show. I have four cats that control the house. It just never ends. I think I'm working on like four books. I can never remember. I can never keep them straight. So it's just typical. This is the life that I chose.
Right on. Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, good. I'm glad. I definitely know you've been staying busy. I was just reading the latest edition of the Barnes Review, the November-December edition. I don't think the new one has come out yet. And it's excellent. You have a number of articles in there, which we will get to. But I wanted to first off talk about Charlottesville really quick. I interviewed Dr. Jim Fetzer a couple weeks ago, and he put together a book called Political Theater in Charlottesville. And you have a chapter, and you have the very first chapter, if I'm not mistaken. And I've interviewed a couple people recently relating to, you know, that attended Charlottesville and sort of just getting into some of these issues and kind of rehashing this very controversial, very high-profile event. So I wanted to start off by talking about this in your chapter in the book. First off, what was it? Could you just maybe lay out your experience briefly? I know that's kind of a big question, but just summarize, you know, what happened that day?
Well, this is the first I'm hearing that I'm in a chapter of a book on Charlottesville. I wasn't contacted, at least I don't think, although my memory is terrible.
Time out. You didn't know that you have a chapter in this book?
I have books published, but I forget.
He's got you listed as a contributor. And I'll have a link over to Dr. Fetzer's.
Never mind. It just came to me. Yes, my memory is worthless. It was requested, I did a piece on it. Okay, now I have entire books published that I can't remember.
So okay. Hold on a second. Oh. He just published this without your knowledge or what?
I thought you meant that they're talking about me, that it's not an article by me.
Oh, no. So Dr. Fetzer, a lot of the books that he does, he has multiple contributors and he's sort of just the editor. And I interviewed him. We weren't even really focusing on this book. We were talking about other issues, but it came up because this is, you know, sort of recent. I think he published it in November of last year or December of last year. So it's, you know, just a couple months old. And I noticed you had a chapter in there. So I wanted to kind of start off by talking about that.
I believe I went to Dave Gahari was the guy who contacted me and asked me to do that.
Oh, right.
What threw me was the name Jim Fetzer. I know the name, but I don't know him. I went through a third party in that respect. That's what threw me.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, anyways, go ahead. What was your experience like in Charlottesville at the Unite the Right rally?
Well, it was very exciting. You know, I've been doing street level protests since I was 17. I've been through it all. I all over the country. I've been arrested. But in this particular case, it was very unique. Unique for a few reasons. Number one, our numbers. You know, we had approaching 2,000 people. I remember the days, wasn't that long ago, where we showed up with 15, 20. We were a scary array if you're a leftist. The second thing that was unique was that there was no police protection. Usually what happens in these things, when there's a counter protest, the police will, keep both sides apart. It's in the city's interest to do that. Well, that didn't happen this time. In fact, they created a situation where there would be a brawl. Now, of course, I was ready for that. But we marched up through this gauntlet of leftists. I'm telling you now, as I think I said it in the article, that they're increasingly emaciated. You know, they're not exactly a threat to anybody. Except in this particular case, I was maced it took me 3 days to regain my sight, which is an odd mace, is usually just a few hours. But it was a bear mace. It was a gel that they use that sticks to the cornea. My eyesight is back. Totally worth it, by the way. It's not the first time I've been injured. It's something like this. We finally made it to the statue, right where we're supposed to be. It took a while to fight our way there. And then we were ordered almost instantaneously to disperse. And even though we had a permit for this and everything, no speaker spoke. And then they sent us right into another Antifa phalanx, which would be fine by me if I could see.
Right. Well, that seems to be kind of what everybody is saying that attended this. That, this seemed to be set up, like the city wanted this to happen. And there are quotes from, for example, the chief of police, where he's basically saying, look, we want to instigate a brawl so that way we can declare and justify a state of emergency, you know what I mean, and shut the whole event down. So it seems very clear that the local political establishment, the city council, the mayor, Wes Bellamy, what is he, like the vice mayor or whatever?
Yes.
Like the local officials, the local municipality, the state officials, and certainly at the federal level. I mean, nobody wanted to see this go down. And it was just such an outrage. It just shows that the First Amendment is totally dead in America.
Well, they try to blame that helicopter crash on us. That somehow the collective hatred of our group brought the helicopter down, and in truth, the helicopter had nothing to do with us. That was guarding the governor's motorcade. It was fairly close by, but that wasn't even involved in the rally at all. Now, I didn't see the car. I didn't see much of anything. I can't think of his name now. Although from what I could see, it was a self-defense move on his part. But I tell you one thing. I think I said this in the article as well. When I went down, it took out about half of our guys, bleach and made everything you could think of. When I went down, our people formed a protective circle around me. My rank and experience, I guess, have earned that, and that helped me very much. And they were, you're not going to touch him, and he's out, so you're not going to touch him again. And then I finally, they helped me to the statue, where two women from the League of the South took some time and cleared out my eyes as best they could. So this was about, brotherhood and self-sacrifice.
Right.
All the groups that were there, every group there I endorse. We have different specialties, but we all agree on the same kind of thing. But it was definitely worth every minute of it.
Yeah. And, there's been a lot of criticism about the event, and I guess we're kind of rehashing a lot of this, but I think that it was a good idea, the whole concept, unite the right. That's something that, well, for me, Matt Heinbach, a lot of us have been saying this for a long time. It's like, look, we all need to recognize that we're on the same team. We don't have to agree on every single detail of every single subject. But, can we at least acknowledge that we should be on the same side, right? I mean, there's been a lot of bickering and just drama in like the right wing movement for decades, it seems like, certainly since I've been involved with it. And I thought this was definitely a step in the right direction, and it seemed to be that. You know, a lot of people have been critical of it, the way it was organized, the way it was handled, etc. But ultimately, I think it was definitely a good idea. I think the concept itself is very much worth pursuing and keeping in mind that, again, you know, we all are on the same team, whether or not we agree on every single, everything, you know, every topic that comes up when we're discussing some of these issues.
But usually it's yeah. not an ideological matter. It's usually a personal matter.
It is, yeah.
We change our minds on some minor issues all the time. So we don't even agree with ourselves all the time. I think credit needs to be given to, Matt Heimbeck and Jeff Scoop, both of whom are amazing leaders. Matt Heimbeck is you know, I baptized him and know him extremely well. I don't know Jeff as well, but he's an admirable leader. And, of course, there's going to be issues we don't agree. So what? That has nothing to do with anything. Our core values are the same. We're fighting the same fight. And, you know, I've said it before, but, you know, I define a brother or a friend of mine as somebody who has a very good chance of sharing a gulag cell with me. And all those guys there are certainly qualified.
Yes. Well said. Well, I'm glad you brought up Heimbeck because the chapter that you wrote for the book, it actually starts off talking about the Pikesville event, which took place. I can't remember the exact date, but it was definitely before Charlottesville. Charlottesville was what, like mid-August, I think, and Pikesville was a month or two before that, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that. It was very warm.
Yeah, it was, you know, sort of back-to-back, but, you know, they sort of happened. They definitely happened, you know, last summer anyways. And Heimbeck was kind of more involved in the at least in organizing the Pikesville event. So do you want to talk about that? Maybe address that, because I thought that was kind of an important point that you made in the article, or in the chapter, I should say.
What? Heimbeck's role, you mean? Or the relationship?
Yeah, no, you start off in the chapter talking about the Pikesville event and how it was sort of like a precursor for what happened in Charlottesville. Yeah.
Well, understand the context here. I'm 46 years old. I've been doing this for many, many years. I remember being surrounded by screaming communists, and there's only like 15 of us. That was the norm. You know, and now we show up with 2,000 people. We show up with 1,500 armed men. Anyone who criticizes this from our side can go to hell. This is an unbelievable. I never thought that I'd live to see this day. And it means that there's this groundswell. People just don't care anymore. They don't care about PC anymore. They're going to do what they have to do to protect themselves. Everyone there. Everyone got along. Everyone spoke. I mean, it was, and I didn't care what group they were. I endorsed them all. They're all, you know, I would take a bullet for any of those guys, and that is not a figure of speech. And I have the feeling that the same goes for them. But the Pikesville event was more boring because we outnumbered the left. God knows, maybe the first time that ever happened. The cops were bored out of their minds. The press afterwards was running pictures of these groups of riot police that never existed. They needed to make that as more violent than it was. It wasn't violent at all. And Pikesville event was just very sad. For the first time in my life, I felt sorry for these guys. There was this woman dressed like a piece of pizza.
Right.
And I went up and I didn't get a chance to speak to her, but I just looked at her with this forlorn look. You poor soul. You know, God knows how tortured this person is to dress up like a piece of pizza, this stupid thing. You know, who knows what abuse she suffered to get to that horrible point in life. But to go from, you know, being a member of a group of 15, you know, to dominate the area, this is unbelievable. And it has to do with the reaction to, of course, the media, the universities, and the fact that the economy cannot recover. Given the amount of debt that exists, and young people know that they have no future. And this is, you know, it's one of the most gratifying things. It brought me right back. You know, I'm more active now than ever because of this. It's a vindication for guys like me and older guys like Willis Cardo and Mike Piper. And I think because we dominated that event to such an extent, maybe the other event was a punishment. It was a way to say, you know, we still run the show, so don't get too cocky. Maybe.
Gotcha. Yeah. No. All good points. I agree with you. I think what's really shown these like high profile alt-right events that go down to these rallies, you know, Pikesville, Charlottesville, et cetera. There's been others. It's really demonstrated just how out of control the left is and how just totally tyrannical. And I mean, they call us fascists, but look at them. I mean, like they're acting like, you know, the mainstream accepted definition of a fascist, right? I mean,
oh, right. Yeah.
They're trying to shut down events. They're violently assaulting people. And this is the thing. They openly say this. They openly advocate that, like, you know, violence against right-wingers is justified because of our speech, because of our political organizing. They argue that our speech and political organizing is itself a form of violence.
Well, do you believe
or at least it will lead to violence. So by preemptively attacking us and shutting us down, it's going to prevent violence. I mean, that's like the type of twisted logic that these people are using. It's insane. And it's really being exposed. You know, people are seeing this and like, wow, the left is really out of control. Look, they're just attacking and you know, assaulting and bear macing and doing all these horrible things, spitting on people, you know, just average Trump supporters. For example, this was demonstrated all throughout the election season, right? I mean, just normal Trump supporters were showing up and being assaulted and spat upon by these out of control, unhinged leftist mobs.
Well, and I've written on this as well, shutting down a rally for the nominee of a major party is illegal under federal law. You can't do that. You can't interrupt that. You can never threaten voters. Voter intimidation, I think, the minimum is 10 years for that. If this happened in another
and
country,
that is what it is.
Yeah. But this there's nothing new here. You know, but what's becoming plainer is that the relationship between corporate America, the state, and Antifa, as I've already always known this, but now it's becoming blatant that they're working together, that they're one unit. You talk about the American press. I should mention that you can't talk to a reporter and say you have a double standard, because they're going to say, yes, so what? That's what they are. They're an activist. They support the left wing, and they're going to say and do. Yeah, they don't believe in those standards anyway. We have to remember this. We have to understand these institutions as a part of a leftist movement, activist institutions. So we can't say, oh, you need to be fair. Well, no, they don't. They're partisan, and they're, you know, and as you say, this is increasingly shrill. They're admitting this openly, as the New York Times did during the Trump campaign. But they're willing to do anything and to say anything. As a Trump, the assaults on him, made up news, whatever they can say, shutting down rallies for a presidential candidate. There's Supreme Court cases on this. They'll stop at nothing.
You know what? I remember vividly watching the rally. It was on YouTube. I wasn't watching the rally. It was a cover, like mainstream coverage of the Trump rally in Chicago that they had to shut down because there was riots outside and people inside were rioting, and it was just total lawlessness and chaos and madness. And I went to a few Trump rallies during the election campaign, and you know, it's basically the same thing, at least outside. The ones that I went to, like, you could go inside and it was fine. But if you go outside, all these Mexicans and brown people are just tearing down the city and flipping over cars and attacking people and all sorts of madness. It's just, I mean, it's really, really obvious, you know, the lines that are being drawn right now.
Well, yeah, again, shutting down a rally for a presidential candidate is illegal. Not just because of it's you know, disturbing the peace and assault and stuff like that, but because you can't interfere with the presidential election, and you certainly can't interfere with voting. Now, if you remember, the Black Panthers in Philadelphia were brought up on charges of voter intimidation for the Obama campaign. Then Obama was elected, and he forced them to drop the case. The law seems to be now that only on the day of the election, you know, if someone's walking to the poll and you stop them for some reason, that's you know, a federal offense. But doing it a month earlier is foggy. And Bernie Sanders, even Obama, had to say, you guys need to cool it, because, you know, there are pretty strict laws about this. You can't interfere with a presidential candidate. You can't interfere with someone voting or supporting a candidate. That is not protected speech at all. That is a violation of the Mississippi burning case, was about that. So, you know, so this is a, and they really, and so you have a, this is supported by corporate America, supported by the main, you know, this is who's financing this. They have a tendency to launder the cash. You know, they give to the Rockefeller Foundation, give to the Ford Foundation, they give to the Ruckus, you know, and you have to take hours to trace the cash. But ultimately, that's where it comes from. It takes a lot of money to organize these things and to bus people in and to have bail money and food and everything else. And it was all coordinated.
Absolutely. Same thing with the Black Lives Matters movement and all of these other, you know, radical Marxist movements that have, you know, become prevalent throughout, I mean, really the past 10 years. It's really kind of stepped into a higher level. But I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, think about it. There are still guys that participated in the Unite the Right rally that are in jail in Charlottesville. I know Chris Cantwell. He's out of jail, but he was locked up for what, 3 months. But there's still guys in jail right now just for participating in the rally. I don't know exactly all the charges leveled against these guys, but I mean, to my knowledge, none of these leftists that were assaulting us are in jail. Are facing charges. I think one of the guys just got charges dropped, in fact, that DeAndre Harris character, or Harrison, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But think about that. We're being, you know, our guys are sitting in jail while the radical left, I mean, they're shutting down events. They're literally engaging in terrorism. I mean, this is what it is. Like, the definition of terrorism is using violence and intimidation to, you know, get what you want politically, and that's what they're attempting to do. And they're open about it. I mean, they're just, this is what they say openly.
It started in the mid-1970s, the so-called Greensboro shootout between the Communist Party and the Klan. And once after that, the ruling class said we need to organize against the right, but the state can't do it. There's a First Amendment issue. So they began to cultivate ties within the far left. And Antifa was born by the early 80s. And, you know, I've seen, you know, they never seem to get into any trouble. Their ranks never seem to diminish. They don't seem to have jobs. And they're very, very well coordinated. There's a lot of money coming from somewhere. These people don't have it. So there's definitely elite support. And what you said about, you know, I've been to jail before from a pro-life rally many years ago when I was in college. I know how miserable it is. And they're deliberately denying bail for someone who's obviously not a flight risk, and they're doing something else to torture him. They'll say to him one day, "Oh yes, yes, you're going to have a hearing where, you know, we're going to allow you to get bailed out." He gets all excited. The next day they come in, "Oh, sorry, it's not going to happen." Now I think they're doing that on purpose. I mean, that's a torture. You know, it's a horrible thing to do.
It's psychological manipulation. Yeah, totally.
And these guys are turning themselves in. So how are they a flight risk? There's not a single leftist who was arrested who wasn't let go on bail, and the money came in from sources that weren't their own. So again, that's old news, but I know what it's like there. Even for a short time, it's terrible. And these guys, we don't even know if they've done anything yet, according to the state. They haven't been tried.
Exactly. Yeah, I know they've been just rotting in frickin' jail in Charlottesville. It's such an outrage, man. It makes me mad.
Think of the combination here. You have young guys who don't, you know, young white guys, you know, guys who otherwise would be winners in society, who don't see a future. That's a good move. They don't have one. And they see stuff like this. They hear about stuff like that. They're attacked at school for saying things, you know, all kinds of stuff happens. And, you know, they're going to join us. They don't see any reason why not. It's not like they have this big career look forward to in the future. Those are becoming scarcer and scarcer. And the left is being so blatant about it, as you say, that you know, this is a huge gamble for them. Now, my biggest fear is that they're going to kill these guys in jail. And I really want to be wrong there, but I think of Edgar Steele. They murdered him in jail. In fact, the coroner's report seems to suggest that. But and of course, who's going to defend him? The press isn't going to defend him. TV isn't going to defend him. So they can get away with it. Are they going to risk a trial? Are they going to risk the scam at Charlottesville being exposed? That's my biggest fear right now. And I know we have guys going down visiting. Then I think we should do that. I know Matt Heinbeck has done it. just to keep them and give them support and everything else, because I know what he's going through, and it's and they're torturing him down there.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. Well, good for him. That's good that we got some support to these guys. I want to say I was listening to the Daily Showa over on the Right Stuff, and I know that they listed the address, you know, and the names of everybody that where you could write them and stuff like that. So you could probably find that over on their website. I don't have all the details, but you know, for people interested, that's certainly something worth doing. I mean, these guys are kind of risking it all, putting it on the line for us, and we should support them.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been me. I mean, I was.
Yeah. Simply for just attempting to, you know, exercise your First Amendment right. That's all that we were attempting to do. Our side was attempting to do that day.
Yeah, I would swear under oath that I saw not the slightest aggressive action on our side. The aggressive action came from them, and we defended ourselves.
Absolutely. That's really the key point that Antifa, the radical left. I mean, they are very explicit about this. Like, that is their goal. There, have you heard of this guy? He's Jewish. Mark Bray. He's a professor, I think, at Dartmouth.
Yes. Not,
yeah. I mean, yeah. This guy wrote this book, the anti-fascist handbook, where he lays this all out. Where, I mean, like literally, they're justifying violence against right wingers by arguing that our speech and political organizing and just, you know, having the views that we have is itself a form of violence.
Now, has Bray been fired?
Not to my knowledge.
Oh,
I just listened to an interview that he did with NPR. I mean, he's being promoted, in the mainstream. Yeah. This is a mainstream, politically accepted, ideas, essentially, which is terrorism. Yeah, he's advocating terrorism. Well, think about it. I mean, they're saying that our speech is violent. Therefore, the type of violence they engage in, and think about it. I mean, this is mob violence. These are people getting, attacked by getting jumped, basically, by multiple people. Unprovoked attacks. Doxing, they're doxing people left and right. Attempting to shut down events. Attempting to shut down speech and debate. And if they can't do that, they'll just get up there and blow their air horn or try to interrupt you or prevent other people from hearing what you have to say. They're saying that this is all justified and it's, the morally righteous thing to do because of the Holocaust. I mean, that's what this guy in this book basically argues. I mean, he's invoking the Holocaust. He's invoking slavery to entirely weaponized, distorted narratives of history that have been articulated and institutionalized by these radical Jewish intellectuals that just basically dictate our reality to us, even though, and they just expect us all to go along with it, blindly, without even thinking about it critically at all. It's totally unacceptable. It's just, it's so incredible what is going on and just how brazen they are.
Well, I need to give a warning to some of these leftists, any of the spies who may be listening here. Our people have been dealing with this for a long time. They're shut out of schools, fired from jobs, they lose children. It's really a bad idea to provoke them. The rage that's been building up there for a long time, once that's released fully, it scares even me. And
it's coming. I mean, that's the thing. I think
they're playing with fire.
Yes. Yeah.
Remember, John, the history is never made by majorities or masses. History is made by fanatical minorities. That's always been the case. So numbers don't matter. The ideas matter, and how we put those into practice matters.
I completely agree. And I think the whole, like the alternative media, the alt-right, sort of like right-wingers in general, we have made a lot of progress just over the course of the past 2-3 years. I mean, I think things are definitely going in the right direction. Of course, we're still being persecuted and targeted and demonized. But, I mean, I think it's only a matter of time before our ideas, our perspectives are mainstream and accepted by people, by the masses, essentially.
Well, my personal opinion, and a shared I know by a lot of our people, is that the present system can't be reformed and it can't recover from its, we're in a depression globally. I don't care what the system calls it, but the level of debt is so high. You know, you're talking about, you know, $30-40 trillion just in the U.S. The credit crunch is so substantial that, and there's no confidence in the future. The system is going to have to come apart. It's in the process of, there's holes in the dam already, and, the system's going to have to collapse. And we're going to have to rebuild. I think that's the only, that's the only option. People, only care about their stomachs. They care about their immediate self-interest. But when the system can't even deliver basic goods anymore, that's when they're going to start rethinking their opinions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's even happening now. I mean, just with the way the media has been totally discredited. I mean, people recognize, you know, how dishonest and how biased the and just dishonest in general the media is. And, you know, I don't know. I to me, I mean, things are really kind of going on in our direction. Our ideas are getting more and more traction, more and more coverage. People are being exposed to them on a daily basis. I mean, almost every day now you can find an article in some local newspaper about how some right-winger just got fired from his job because he was doxxed or someone saw his Facebook posts or some bullshit like that, you know? So people are really – people are seeing this and, like – you know, I don't know. I'm just optimistic about it, to be honest.
Well, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think you're right. I've been fired from several university jobs. I was fired from Mount St. Mary's University, and there was the students had a rally to get me back. 181 students and former students. You know, it's happening. About half of them were non-white. They disliked me as a professor.
Wow.
But when the regime forces these people to do that, it's not really from a position of strength. My view, I just published an article on my Patreon page about this right now. You know, again, recovery is impossible. The youth unemployment rate in Portugal, Spain, and Greece is 50%. There's no hope for these people. There's no credit. No one's starting new businesses. The money isn't there.
50%. Wow.
That's official statistics.
That's
probably much.
That's incredible. Well, think about
it. 25. So wait, hang on a minute.
Oh, yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is, you're an elite multi-billionaire. How are you interpreting this? It seems to me that the only rational thing from their point of view is to say, okay, we need to start stripping assets. We're not going to invest now because we don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now. So they have this short-term mentality. We got to take what we can now and quickly before the whole thing collapses. That means for us that they're going to be lashing out. They're going to be hiring these hordes of migrants or whatever it is to enforce their regime. And that's what this is all about. Antifa really is their bodyguard. Their agenda is identical. And these are the kind of informal methods that the ruling class is going to use to defend themselves in these last, you know, the last dying days of the regime while they're just stripping assets and shipping it to a bank account in the Caymans.
Yes, sir. I think you're definitely on the right track. It's very good to be alive right now to me. I mean, seeing how far we've come and seeing how much media coverage our ideas are getting now, it's really great to see. I really love it, and I think I'm just optimistic about it. So,
well, the Trump election is another one. We both watched on television Trump voters being openly threatened and attacked. Catch from rallies, everything else. I mean, every federal law on this stuff they've broken, and yet he still won.
Right.
And he dominated.
Right. And you look and the most mainstream of people too, like people that really aren't even, you know, quote unquote racist or anything like that, you know, just average patriotic Americans are just being attacked by these people in the streets simply for wanting to support their country. You know, putting America first. I mean, how basic is that? And you know, that's racist. Give me a break.
Yeah, and these conservatives are going to realize that they can't hide anymore. They can't say, I'm not racist, but there's going to be a point where they just have to say, they're going to be called it anyway, and they just need to deal. And they need to come right out and say what they mean and stop being so damn scared and stop virtue signaling. Mm-hmm. And if you've got to suffer a little bit, too bad. You suffer a little bit. Well, that's how great things are done.
I'll tell you who's doing that right now and who I'm very impressed with, for the most part, is Paul Nealon, the guy running against he's running against Paul Ryan for Congress in Wisconsin, I believe. Yeah, in Wisconsin. Have you been following him?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not even worth getting into right now, but check him out. I'll send you his info. He's on Twitter, and he's really just totally openly addressing the Jewish question and racial issues and many other controversial topics, which actually kind of leads us into our next topic. I want to talk about Russia and in an article published by Russia Insider that has generated some headlines and, you know, some chatter on the internet. Before we talk about Russia Insider, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you have some articles published in the recent edition of the Barnes Review. It's the November-December 2017 edition of the magazine. And I hope all of our listeners are subscribing to the Barnes Review. It really is an excellent publication. I'm holding this edition I'm talking about in my hands right now, and it's good. It's definitely worth supporting. I mean, I don't know of any other print publications that are dealing with these very controversial topics in the manner that the Barnes Review is. So I think it's an organization worth supporting. But the whole edition is kind of focused on Russian history and investigating the slaughter of the Romanovs, the Russian royal family. And so that's kind of the focus of the issue. You have some articles in there dealing with related topics, and it kind of coincides with an article that it was sent to me actually by a friend of mine. This is from the end of November, but apparently Russia, like the official government in Russia, launched an investigation into the murder of the royal family. Or what do you know the details of this? Of the investigation.
Well, yes, I do. This is, I am the nationalist movement's Russia guy. And I was hired at the Barnes Review as that many years ago. In Eastern Europe and in Russia in particular, the Jewish question is mainstream. It's day to day. They talk about it, on the floor of the Duma. It's mainstream there. Well, of course, not here. That kind of criticism out over there is very common. And so it's not really a big deal for them, but this is the 100th anniversary of the murder of the royal family. And the evidence is overwhelming that this was a ritual killing. And Vladimir Putin and the Russian government want to get to the bottom of this scientifically and to find out the ritual elements of this. And of course, by ritual, I mean Kabbalistic Judaic. Now, the U.S. Government went wild. But in Russia, that's pretty normal. I think probably the majority opinion in Russia is that it was one, and that it was a Jewish matter. That's kind of day to day street corner stuff. So I don't. And now how this panel is developing their research, I don't know, but they haven't released their findings yet.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was sent this article, and there's a couple other articles that basically say the same thing. I'm looking at an article in the Daily Mail that was published originally on November 28th of last year, and it discusses this, the official investigation into the death, and some are arguing it's again a Jewish ritual murder, which there's a lot of evidence to demonstrate that actually. And I mean most people listening to our podcast are familiar with the history of communism and how Jewish it was, the Jewish nature of it, the Jewish nature of the Bolshevik Revolution, for example. And this murder, I mean, it's addressed at length in the Barnes Review, but it essentially was a gang of Jewish criminals that just totally overthrew the Russian government, essentially. Of course, you're the expert in this, so you could probably elaborate on a little bit more, but that's essentially what happened. And it's, to me, it's very encouraging that the Russian government would openly investigate this, right?
Well, it's a nationalist government. Moderate, sort of a social nationalist state. Let me tell you, not a lot of our readers or your listeners don't know this, but the Communist Party, the Russian Federation, is essentially national Bolshevik. They agree with us on almost everything. They are not an atheist group. They are Russian nationalist, Pan-Slavic, Eurasian. They're not white nationalists, neither is Putin, but they're part of the Eurasianist movement, the so-called non-aligned movement. It is not the Communist Party. They would throw, the hippies in jail.
I'm curious because you say they're not white nationalists, but what is the distinction between like the Dugin faction versus like I guess more like American like white nationalism alt-right type thinking? What is the difference? I mean, are they not racial realists, or how would you describe the difference between our views, I guess?
Well, they're both, you know, the people, you know, I know Dugan's work extremely well. I've read everything he's put out in the original. And, you know, race doesn't play a huge role, although he certainly recognizes it as very important. Because of Russia's position, of course, most of it's in Asia. And the economic future for Russia should be aimed at China and Central Asia. I think that's just common sense. And the Chinese government and government of Kazakhstan and everything else are at war with the New World Order, and they say so. And this is organized in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the official founded by Russia and China. It will be dumping the dollar for oil sales and everything else. It's a military alliance as well as an economic alliance that has really as its central core thing the destruction of American liberal capitalism and the New World Order. So they're not making any bones about this. That's why no one's ever heard of it. So you can't, you know, they're Russian nationalists to be sure, but they certainly believe that other civilizations are equal to theirs, just very different. But Hitler says the same thing in Mein Kampf when he's talking about the Japanese culture. He says that they're older than ours, and we are, you know, they're not better or worse, but we respect them both. And I, you know, Hitler was had no problem with that. The Japanese were the Aryans of the East. So in that sense, Dugin is more of a national socialist than anything else. The big dividing line is 1941. It's going to be really hard to convince Russians that, you know, Hitler was a good guy when he killed so many Russians, even though we know that Stalin was a problem, not Russian people. But they can't get over the fact that people like Rosenberg and Himmler were anti-Slavic and wanted to colonize the area, and the being Eric Cook in Ukraine, et cetera. And so you're not going to get a real love of Hitler there. But you will have the National Socialist ideology, which is everywhere there. They don't call it that. The Communist Party is one of the groups that are like this. The minute you took the Jewish element out of it, they all become patriots. And this is what Putin went through. So you see, you know, they'll be talking just like we do, page after page after page, and then you'll see a picture of Lenin, and you'll go, "What?" No, you have to understand from their point of view. You know, they see Bolshevism not as communism or Marxism or Judaic, but they see it, at least under Stalin, as Russian nationalists. Now, I don't think that's true. I reject that point of view. But Americans have trouble, you know, saying how much they agree with the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. Because that's a nationalist and a national Bolshevik institution using the hammer and sickle, which is really hard for some of us to look at, but you have to get used to it. This is why we have specialists in this area. So we could, you know, go through all that and understand.
Very interesting. Yeah. It's almost like it's basically an alt-right, a Russian version, I guess, of like sort of alt-right thinking, you know, like from a Russian perspective, which to me makes a lot of sense. I mean, growing up in America and having, you know, the education I have and the historical perspective, it's obviously going to be much different than someone who grew up in Russia, you know, learning about Russian history and you know, everything that they experienced. So I think it's interesting, and I think there's probably a lot of overlap and similarities in our thinking, and that's what we should really be focusing on rather than the differences, you know what I mean? Because it seems like we're all pretty much on the same page again.
Well, and you have very powerful governments that happen to agree with us. It's one thing you want to defend your civilization, you want to defend the race, you want to defend your ethnicity. That's okay. But that doesn't imply that somehow you can't work with Chinese or Japanese. They have an extraordinary civilization. It's different. And they shouldn't mix. But there is no reason why we shouldn't be aligned. That makes a lot of sense to me. And that's exactly the Eurasians' point of view. They don't believe in mixing anything, but they understand that the economic future is not in the West. It's, you know, what is the point at this stage? They're so indebted and decadent. No, they are looking to the East, and their right to do so.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. It makes a lot of sense to me as well. Well, you know, let's talk about this Russia Insider article. I sent you a link to it. You read this whole thing, and it sounds like you comment. I didn't even see your comment, by the way. I was trying to find it.
Well, yeah, I rolled my eyes at it, because here's how this stuff. I've been saying those very same things for 20 years now. a handful of others have. These guys initially looked at us and said, oh, they're crazy. But then over time, they're starting to wonder. They see that we're getting followers, that there's a lot of facts on our side. So then after all these years of staying on the sidelines or even condemning us, they say, and they write something like that as if that's his idea. So I roll my eyes, say, yeah, welcome aboard. I've only been saying that for 20 years. It pisses me off that I'm not cited in there since I'm the leader of that whole thing. I don't know if he's just an idiot or if he has a problem with me or what. But I'm seeing this happen a lot. For example, 9/11 thing. When the 9/11 debunkers were assaulted when it first happened. But now you have Republicans talking about it. You know, they stand on the sidelines. Let's see how it works out. Let's see what's safe to say and what's not. When they think it's safe, then they come out and say it like they're revolutionaries. And it really gets me angry. It's cowardly. And so this article, it's good. Old news. I roll my eyes and I say, welcome aboard. It's about damn time.
Yeah, no, I hear you, but I totally hear what you're saying, because I've been saying these things from day one, essentially, that since I've been like writing on the internet anyways. But to me, this article comes across as this guy, Charles Bossman is his name. I don't know much about this website, frankly, or this individual, but it sounds like he hasn't been involved in journalism for long at all. It sounds like he's sort of new to this. But what struck me is that just the very straightforward manner in which he's basically arguing, look, you can't understand what's going on in Russia, what's gone on in Russian history, what's going on in the world today, without understanding the role that Jews have played. I mean, certainly in Russian history, and you can appreciate that as a historian of Russia, a scholar of Russian history and Russian religion and culture, etc. So that was kind of what struck me, is it was very sort of genuine almost and just matter of fact. It's like, look, we can't understand what's going on. We can't figure any of this out unless we talk about Jews. That's kind of what he's arguing here.
And you're going to be seeing this.
And I agree with you. Like, I've been saying this for a very long time, as have you, and many others. But, I thought it was good the way he kind of put this.
Well, and we're going to be seeing this a lot. But guys like that need to realize that they're saying what they're saying because of all the work that we did and the suffering and the crap that was thrown on us. That's what makes their arguments now have any kind of force. And they need to recognize that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And it's kind of one of those things where the more our ideas and perspectives start to penetrate into, more mainstream society, it truly is. I mean, as this guy argues here, as Charles argues, I mean, it really is unavoidable. You have to confront the Jewish question at some point if you really want to figure out what the hell is going on. And again, he's writing for a Russian publication. You definitely can't understand Russian history without understanding the role Jews have played. Again, going back to this, the latest edition of the Barnes Review, the assassination, the overthrow of the Russian government, the Bolshevik Revolution, communism in Russia, etc. The role that Jews played is instrumental in all of this. You really can't understand any of this unless you understand that. So, I appreciate that. I, again, it's something that, you and I have been saying for a very long time. But I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. Like, this Russia Insider, I don't know how popular it is. It seems like it's a pretty well-established website.
Yeah, well, I've read their stuff. Yeah, they write a lot of good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm looking at some of the other contributors. It's not the most radical thing out there, but this is good. I like seeing things like this.
And the only reason that his colleagues will have a problem with that is fear. And this has got to become more and more obvious. And, Joe Sobrin used to say, leaving Jews out of American politics is like leaving the Chicago Bulls out of the NBA.
Exactly. I mean, it's so true. Yeah.
And people sound like idiots when they try to craft an argument without mentioning them. But there is one place where mainstream historians will talk about it, and that's historians of Russia and Ukraine, because 80% of the world's Jewish population lived in the Polish Empire in the early modern era, and their behavior was abominable. And, as the leaseholders of so many land, including churches, And you do see mainstream historians admitting this. Now, it's an obscure topic. It's not going to make it into the mainstream. But there are areas where even English-speaking mainstream historians have to admit that, damn, you know, they really asked for the Khmelnytsky rebellion. And wherever they've gone, they've made everyone miserable, and the charges are exactly the same. Pornography, prostitution, loan sharking, scamming. It's all the same thing over and over and over again. And right. The arrogance that they treat the peasantry. So Eastern Europe has a, you know, it's very mainstream to talk about this there. And I want to make a comment here. Some people have said that the Russian government has an anti-Holocaust denial law. Now, I've read this in the original. I remember when it first came out. It's nothing of the kind. No one's ever been prosecuted under it, first of all. And Holocaust-denying conferences occur in Russia and Ukraine all the time. What it does, and I think it's stupid, but it symbolically bans anyone saying that the Red Army wasn't the main force that destroyed Hitler. And that's really what it was. It's symbolic. No one's been prosecuted under it. I'm not entirely sure why it's there. But you have the old Soviet patriotic crap still around. And so that's why that's so. I want to make it clear that no one's ever been prosecuted for anything. And their Holocaust denial stuff on a regular basis. Mainstream publications talk about it. So it's not illegal there.
Well, that's good to hear, because multiple people are being arrested all across the Western world, including Monica Schaefer. Did you hear about her situation over in Germany?
Is that the old lady, the grandmother?
Well, that's Ursula Haverbeck.
Oh, I think
you're thinking of. Yeah. Monica Schaefer. Monica. Yeah, I know. Right. I mean, all these nice old ladies getting arrested for questioning the Holocaust, for God's sake. It's so outrageous. I hate to even laugh about it. It's just so insane.
How can the average German look at this law and say and defend it? It's only one group of people. Only one historical event has this aura of sanctity around it. No other mass slaughter, no other mass killing, no other war, no other group of people. It's unavoidable. And at some point, even sympathetic people are going to have to say, you know, this is garbage. They dominate. And they're so arrogant about it that they forbid us to even talk about it.
Right, exactly. And I know that's what's really so just Orwellian about it is, like, you can literally quote Jews saying, like boasting about the fact that they own Hollywood, for example, or, you know, they run the government, or they, you know, own all the banks on Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, etc. You can quote Jews openly admitting this. And you can demonstrate, you know, objectively, like, look, yeah, this Jew owns this bank, this Jew owns this Hollywood studio, etc. And yet, you'll still be called an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist for pointing this out. It's, I mean, the most...
Well, then you say thank you.
I know, that's the thing. Well, it's like, we kind of, that's kind of how I frame things. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, I am... an anti-Semite. I mean, I do recognize the power and influence that Jews have in our society and the agendas that they... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that, and that's, to me, the way I approach it. I mean, that's the only way to make sense of it, because it's just so ridiculous. You know, it's like, gosh, we're grown-ups here. We can, you know, we can talk about these things objectively and honestly.
We've all been in debates. Listen, all your listeners, I've been in a million of these debates. Where you pile fact upon fact upon fact upon fact. You're very nice about it. You're very logical about it. And they refuse. They can't. There's a short circuit where they keep spouting the same things in different words over and over again. And then they call you names and stuff like that. There's a short circuit in there. And I'm almost not being metaphorical here. And it comes from two things. It comes from conditioning and fear.
I agree. Yeah.
They deny that. If they say that, you know, the U.S. was behind 9/11 or the Holocaust was mythology, they're going to have to question everything in their lives. They're going to have to question everything they've ever said, all their presuppositions, their whole lifestyle, and those around them. How many people are prepared to do that? It's so much easier to be an idiot.
Yes.
It's so much easier to go along. We can, no conflict that way, and you know, you're useless. But if you're afraid of conflict and you just don't want any trouble, that's what you got to say. And more people are cognizant of that. You know, we'll have a job for them after the revolution. Who knows what? They'll answer the phones, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, you had mentioned how the Jewish question or the Jewish problem is probably more accurate. How these topics, you know, these kind of controversial topics in the West are openly addressed and discussed in Russia, in Ukraine, and other, you know, Eastern European countries, which, I mean, I've never been there. I don't doubt you at all. It certainly does seem to be the case. And let me just cite one example. I posted this over on my Twitter feed. I you know, just tweeted out the link. They had an interview with Russia's she's a spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry. Her name is Maria Zakharova. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
We'll give you a pass.
But yeah, anyways, very, very attractive lady, by the way. Blonde hair, blue eyes, very good looking. Very well spoken, it appears, you know, very knowledgeable. She says this, she says, if you want to know what's going to happen in America, who do you have to talk to? You have to talk to the Jews, naturally. And I got a kick out of that. I thought that was awesome. It's, I mean, again, going back to this, you know, the main point that this article at Russia Insider is making, you have to talk about the Jews if you want to understand what's going on, not only in America, not only in Russia, but in the world in general, right?
Well, there's no doubt about it. And you're going to have to prepare those of us who do this full time. You know, there's a Rubicon to be crossed. I remember talking to E. Michael Jones around the time he crossed his. Joe Sobert, you know, you have to make the decision. I'm going to cross this Rubicon. What's more important? Is honesty and truth and integrity more important? Or is happiness and social acceptability more important? Well, for me, that was easy. For others, it's not so much. There's a lot to lose there. And there's going to be more, you know, professors and scholars who just, they can't take it anymore. I'm being told the lie, and I'm not just going to, you know, just take the easy route all the time. And so they'll say it in whispers. They'll say it after a few shots, maybe, but in public, it's another matter. But, Americans of all, you know, any right wing or even moderate left opinion has to realize that it's, you know, you may have to suffer, and that's just how it goes. The truth is more important.
That's life. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The truth is more important. Being an honest, you know, principled individual is more important than, you know, losing a job or something like that. To me, anyways, and I think a lot of people.
Think about how hard that is, though. I mean, it's easy to say it. I've lived it, thank God. And there have been days where I didn't think it was worth it. And so, but it's a very, very hard thing to do. You're going to lose family. You're going to lose friends. You're going to end up being somewhat of an outcast. My advice to people in approaching this is to be friends first. When I, went to grad school, for example, I didn't start, you know, talking about, you know, Kodrianu right away on the first day. You know, you need to let them know that you're a nice guy, that you're friendly, that you're normal, you know. And then later on, once they get to know you, you say a few things and they'll say, oh, that's Matt. He's nuts. You know, you're not a threat anymore because they know you're a good guy. You have to make friends with, you know, wherever you are. I know the university system, but wherever you are, you can't just walk in and start preaching. You have to let them know first and foremost that you're a decent guy, you're a peaceful guy, and then slowly reveal your personality. By then, they'll realize you're not a threat. As I said to you earlier, that the only problem you have to worry about is outside pressure. But as far as, you know, even social circle stuff, it's they know you're a decent guy. They know you're a smart guy. And so when you say something out of the mainstream, they're not going to immediately want to kill you. And that's how I got through the university system. And that's my advice to anybody in that similar situation.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a good strategy.
It's a hard life.
Hard life. Yeah. Yeah. No doubt about that. Lots of challenges. But you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, I'm just trying to be intellectually honest with myself, and this is the route you take if you start trying to figure out what's going on in the world. You know, you're eventually going to become an anti-Semite if you really are thinking critically about the information you're consuming.
I'm telling you that, and this is still hard for me to wrap my head around, that virtually everything that the average educated American believes about the world is wrong. And
yeah, well, it's true. It is true, and it's wrong. It's wrong because it's basically, I don't even know if I'd describe it as wrong. It's just a Jewish narrative. That's what it is. I mean, when you think about it, every single narrative, every single perspective, basically, that's presented in the mainstream, that's presented in, you know, mainstream television, in Hollywood, in, you know, our educational establishment, it's all filtered through a Jewish lens. Ultimately, we have a Jewish perspective of the world, and what we're doing, we're offering something totally different. We're critiquing that. We're pointing out the flaws in it. We're pointing out the lies and you know, everything else that goes with it.
Well, those at the universities, those who profit from this are very lazy intellectually. They're like the Soviet Union in the 1970s. Yeah, they're spouting the line. They don't really believe it. They're spouting the line because they don't want any trouble. Those people have never heard our position put rationally before. They only know caricatures. You know, they know mockery and stuff like that. They've never actually heard, you know, our position put in an academic form as I do. I know that there are a lot of mainstream academics who read my stuff. They'll die before they admit it, but they do. And that means that our enemies are very soft. They're not used to a lot of challenges. And they hear the stuff that we put forth, you know, in a very rational and academic way, and they don't know what to say.
They can't, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they truly can't deal with it intellectually. I don't know if you've been, have you been following any of these debates on YouTube with like alt-right people versus sort of skeptics who seem to me to be kind of, I don't know. I'm not impressed. I don't know. I don't follow YouTube, all this stuff on YouTube closely at all, but there's been a lot of controversy with these debates and I've seen some of them. And I'm just very unimpressed with the quote-unquote skeptic community, which I don't even know exactly what that is. But they're definitely not in line with sort of like alt-right thinking on racial issues, on the Jewish question, and many other topics. Have you seen any of this, like any of these debates by chance?
No, I have a life. No, I haven't.
Right, I know. I should have known.
Well, I mean, I appreciate, give me a chance to.
No, it's just go ahead. Yeah.
The biggest problem right now is our education. Our level of scholarship is very low. I don't like alt-right. I don't know what that even is. Neither do they. The nationalist movement, I think, is the easiest thing to say.
I agree with that.
Yeah. We don't have tons of scholars. We don't, you know, and a lot of stuff is falling to me, and there needs to be more of them. But that's really hard to do. You know, I blazed a trail here. E. Michael Jones would be the other one. Michael Hoffman is another one. Our level of, you know, scholarship is extremely low. We don't have even an academic journal. I guess the Occidental Quarterly is the closest thing. But that's it. You know, for a movement of millions of people. So I'm impressed. I'm not impressed with our own people. But when compared with the opposition, you know, they're woke, which unfortunately is a sad, but that's a big task of our maturity, learning how to deal with others, each other. That's the two big challenges I think we have right now.
Sure. No, I totally hear you. I guess my point is that it's so, like, the people that attempt to refute our ideas or to deal with our ideas, it's really pathetic. I mean, they can't even do it. It's very, very sad. You know, like,
they import someone, ideas into our views that we don't have.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I end up having to say, no, we don't really believe that. No, we never said that. No. And that's usually what the whole debate comes down to.
Yeah, it's true, but I don't know. I guess you'd have to take a look at some of these debates, which obviously you have a life, so you don't even have time to do. I haven't seen all of them, but the ones that I have seen, I've been very unimpressed with our ideological opponents. So, anyways, Dr. Johnson,
you're being very charitable. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I told you I'd keep you here about an hour. We're a little bit over the hour mark. I want to thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's great to catch up. Good to hear from you. Good to talk to you, as always. Keep up the good work. I really – the articles in the Barnes Review that we discussed briefly are excellent. I do hope people subscribe and support the publication. I think it's very worth, you know, worth supporting. So I do want to say that. And again, I want to thank you very much for coming on. Do you have any concluding remarks you'd like to make?
Well, I pretty much said everything I came on here to say. You were cutting in a minute. I hope I didn't miss anything. My concluding remark here is going to be is that if you want to become a part of this, if you want to become a regular part of this, you're going to suffer. Pain is not necessarily up, but you are going to suffer.
Well, there's no doubt about that. But if we want to survive and live in this world, suffering is part of it. So, you know what? We are definitely losing our connection. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much. I will talk to you very soon.